Standout with Ian O'Connell on Radio Kerry.
Now, you're very welcome to Standout with me, Ian O'Connell. I hope I find you well on this Wednesday evening. I'm delighted to say that my guest this week on Standout is former President of the GAA and current MEP Sean Kelly. Sit back and enjoy the show. Sean, thanks, William, for coming on today, and I appreciate it.
Delighted to do so, Ian.
All of my guests, Sam, I don't know if you've heard any of the interviews so far, but I like to bring all my guests kind of back to the start, growing up. You grew up in Kilcommon originally, did you?
I'm born and reared in Kilcommon, a place called Knuckletaggal Moor, which means the Hill of the Rye, which would indicate that long ago there was tillage in that area. And I grew up there, very nice neighbours, quiet, peaceful, but we were quite happy even though we didn't have a whole pile, the same as everyone else. But looking back on it, I don't have any great memories of really bad times as such. We just got on with it. I was probably of the last vintage alive now that walked to school barefoot. And then I remember when the roads were tarred for the first time, the tar sticking to our feet and so forth. So I go back a long way, you know, but Kilcommon is where I was born and reared, and delighted to have played football for them for many years. And I'm still a Kilcommon man to a large degree, but I'm also a Fossa man because I've actually spent longer in Fossa now than I did in Kilcommon. And Fossa, of course, is a great place to live as well. Great club here in the GAA with a great community, and I'm very happy to be here.
Very good. My mom grew up in Kilcommon. Were you far? How far away were you from her?
She was only across the valley from us.
Go away.
I suppose as the crow flies, about 2 or 3 miles at the most. And of course, that time, there were no houses close to one another. The nearest house to us, our neighbours, would have been about 500 metres away. The next house would have been down the post office, I suppose. And the village, as they call it now, Kilcommon, would be about a kilometre away or thereabouts, maybe a kilometre and a half. So our neighbours were not that many, but they were very dear. And the distance didn't make any difference that time. If you were within 3 or 4 miles of somebody, they were your next door neighbour.
Just mad to think back, and it's all, like you said, next door neighbour, and they could be 3 or 4 miles away. The Kilcommon village itself, is it back then when you were talking about, was the post office there, you said, but was it a way different to what it's now?
It's a way different, and they made a wonderful job with the landscape and the garden there, nature garden, the church, of course, and all that. But really, there were only 3 houses there when I was going up, and for many, many years. One was the post office, where the McCartys are, Rena and Marish, and them are now. The other was the Tishilis, was another shop. And then the third was my grandparents' house, right in the round in the corner, as you went around the corner of the village. And that was it. And there was nobody really living there because my grandparents died in their 60s. So my uncle, Sean, who would be, I'm called after, he played for Kerry in the 50s. He and his family would come down there during the summer and occasionally, but that was the size of it. So to say it was a village, in today's terms, it certainly wouldn't qualify. So really there were 2 shops and a house that was occupied occasionally. And my grandfather actually had a shop in his time, because he was an auctioneer, Brian Kelly, and then when he closed the shop, Tish Healy opened the shop across the way, and that was the size of it. But that was great, because everything revolved around the post office and Tish's. That's where he went for all your supplies. There was very little going to town to buy food at that time.
A lot different. So you said you're a proud Kilcommon man, played football. Did you play any other sports growing up?
Do you know, football was the only sport really at the time, and I was fortunate to be on the Kilcoman team that won the Odenhoe Cup in 73 in the County Junior Championship and the County League, and played for many years subsequently. I played till I was about 40. I enjoyed every bit of it. But then when I became involved in the East Kerry Board and in the County Board, I was responsible for hurling in Kerry. At that time, the vice chairman used to be responsible for hurling. And I was elected vice chairman in 1982. So I said I'd want to be doing something about hurling in East Kerry. And we started off. We got called a meeting of people like Johnny Cullity and Pat Doyle, great Pat Doyle, whose son actually lives in Kilcoman. And just above the post office now. That was one of the first houses to be built there. And then I started hurling, and then I started doing a bit of hurling myself. So I started, we formed St. Pat's, which is still going strong, St. Pat's East Kerry, and I played a bit of hurling with them, as did my late brother Padraig, and we won the County Intermediate Championship 2 years. So hurling, yeah. And then when I went to Pat's, I played a little bit of soccer, and of course I played basketball. You always had a chance to play basketball, especially when you went to college. And I did a bit of running. We did a lot of running in the SEM, and I was there. I represented the SEM a few times and did a bit of running. So anything that was going, I had to go with it.
That's the job. I know when I was in the SEM, the only time I played basketball was to get out of a class during the day. You qualified as a primary school teacher originally in college, didn't you?
That's correct, Ian. Many people have that forgotten now.
St. Patrick's College, was it?
St. Patrick's College from Quandra. Went there in 69 to the 2 year course, that time qualified in 71, and taught in Dublin for 4 or 5 years out in a place called Kilmore West, out close to the airport. Coolock would be what is probably more famous. He known as now, and I enjoyed every bit of it. And I went to college in it night and did a degree, and then I was offered a job by the late Father Johnny O'Donovan, who was president of the SEM at the time, and I took the job, and I came down again to Kerry, and I'm here since 1975. So I spent a lot of years in the SEM, enjoyed it, great community there, great spirit, and of course football is king in the SEM, always was and always will be.
A great sporting school, even to this day. They're very successful in football and even in other sports. Firstly, after you said you were a primary school teacher, you swayed more into the kind of politics side of things then. Do you want to tell me exactly what an MEP is, you know, for people that are listening, and what does their role involve?
Yeah, I didn't really ever get involved in politics much. I took an interest in it, the same as everybody does, because politics decides our lives, really, because that's where the laws are made that we abide by. And I was asked to go for the Dáil by Indy Kinney once or twice, and prior to him, John Bruton. And for one reason or another, I didn't stand. But then Indy Kinney got back to me and asked me, would I stand for Europe? And I was reluctant enough, quite frankly, because I was the executive chairman of the Irish Institute of Sport, which I had the privilege of setting up in Dublin at that time. And it's gone well since, thankfully, as we see by the successes of our rowers, athletes and boxers. But I looked at it and I said, you know, if I don't do it now, I'll never do it. So I said, I'll give it a go. And I did. And thankfully, I was elected to the European Parliament. And I'm very honoured to represent not just Kerry, Ireland South in the European Parliament. And I like the European Parliament, the way it works. It's not like the Dáil, where you have government and opposition, and everybody on the side of the government votes with the government, and everybody in the opposition invariably votes against the government on every issue, regardless of its merits. Whereas in Europe, you can only get legislation passed if you get a majority of people to agree with you. So that's a challenge, because everybody can vote really the way they want to vote. Well, there'd be groups there who would kind of have a policy. If you didn't agree with the policy, you didn't have to support it, and there would be no real consequences Whereas, of course, in the Dáil, if the government TDs voted against the government and the government lost, they'd probably turn over to the party. So that doesn't happen in Europe, and that's something I liked, because it meant that every vote had to be taken seriously. Every issue had to be debated, and if you couldn't bring people with you, you wouldn't be successful. So in some respects, Ian, it was like a continuation of the GA in that respect, because in the GA, the same, people vote according to what they think on the merits, demerits of a proposal, and the majority decides. And it's the same in the European Parliament, which I think is very, very pleasing for me, because it means you work harder and you can get better results.
It's very interesting. Like you said, it's a lot different to the Dáil. We were talking before we went on air here about travelling and stuff. There's a lot of travelling involved in the job. You were saying over to Australia there recently and stuff. Do you ever get burnt out?
Thank God, no. So far, so good. Even just 2 weeks ago now, I was asked to go on a mission to Australia, because I'm on the trade committee and we're doing, at the moment, negotiating a free trade agreement with Australia and New Zealand. And it was very important that the committee for the Parliament would go there and meet the ministers and the stakeholders and everybody involved. So, okay, I said I would, but it involved driving to Dublin, flight to Heathrow, Heathrow to Taiwan, Taiwan to Sydney, Sydney to Canberra, and starting at 8 o'clock in the morning. So it's demanding, but that's the way it has to be, because when you go that distance, you've got to make the most of it, so you have meetings all day long, but you make a lot of progress, and you learn new perspectives, and more importantly, you're able to give them the perspectives of Ireland. And one of the things I was able to do there, especially in relation to agriculture, was to tell the Australians and the New Zealanders what the Irish view would be of free trade agreements and how it would impact maybe on them. And also that the free trade agreement which they are doing with the United Kingdom, how that might impact on us as well. And then, of course, with the whole question of climate change and the challenge of reducing emissions, etc. So all that was good discussions. And I was delighted, because I was known in the end as the New Zealand Australian MEP from Ireland, because everywhere I went, everybody we met had Irish connections. I couldn't believe it. The minister, the first person we met, had Irish connections. The second fellow spent 5 minutes telling us about his Irish connections. It was great for me, but for the other MEPs from all over Europe, I think it kind of bamboozled them a bit. And it also, of course, enhanced our reputation, because the Irish are over there and do great work.
If you want to get in contact with me throughout the show with any questions or requests, you can contact me through my Instagram, enoconnell321, or through my email address, ioconnell@radiokerry.ie.
Stand Out with Ian O'Connell on Radio Kerry.
Now, you're very welcome back to Stand Out with me, Ian O'Connell. I'm here today with former President of the GAA and current MEP Sean Kelly. If you're just joining us, the full interview will be up on the Radio Kerry website in the podcast section after the show, or you can now get all the shows I've done so far on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Stand Out with Ian O'Connell. Anywhere you go in the world, you're going to make some connection to an Irish person, a Kerry person, even in some places.
Absolutely. And even when we went to New Zealand after Australia to meet those ministers, etc. there, and we met the Maoris, and one of the first people to come up to me was a Maori. He wanted to photograph with me because he said his grandfather was Irish. So we're everywhere. We're great.
Everywhere, and all getting rid of us. Is there a long process before you get the position as an MEP? Is there a lot of before that, is there a long process to get to that position?
It is a thing I often wonder about in terms of politics. There is no process as such. Anybody can become a politician, and you could get any job regardless of your background or knowledge. which is not a good thing in many respects, because in most jobs you have to have qualifications. But in politics, the process really is that you put yourself forward for election, you campaign, and if you're elected, you become an MEP or a TD or a councillor or whatever it is. Most go with their party, and of course, if you're with the party has to nominate you. You can't go forward yourself. But nothing stopping people to stand independently. And I suppose that's a good thing in many respects, because that's what democracy is about. Everybody's view is equally important, and everybody's voice should be heard. And by and large, despite the fact that there are independent qualifications required, most of those who occupy positions are fairly well qualified. And that was one of the things that struck me, particularly when I met the various ministers in New Zealand and Australia, and indeed other places as well, was their in-depth knowledge of what is going on around them and of the issues they are dealing with. And I suppose it's maybe some of them would have a background in it, but if they didn't, they'd study it and they'd be well informed by the civil servants, etc. So it isn't really necessary to have major qualifications. The most important thing is to be able to get a grasp of the issues and to make strong and brave and correct decisions. And I think to give most politicians their due, I think most of them are there motivated by trying to improve society and do things better than if they weren't involved at all.
Absolutely. I was reading on online, you were awarded MEP of the Year in, was it 2012 and 2020?
I was actually MEP of the Year 3 years, and I was runner-up 2 years. So that's...
You're like Dublin going for 5 in a row.
So it's a very rewarding, because you have to be nominated by people who are watching what's going on in Europe, and then you're voted by the MEPs themselves. So to get that award, it's very, very encouraging. And it's also very satisfying, because you feel that the work you're doing, sometimes you think it hasn't been noticed, but when you get an award like that, well, like yourself, Ian, you stand out. Somebody must be seeing what you're doing and appreciating it. And I think that's the best part of an award like that. You feel that your work has been appreciated and you're doing something positive, which is very important as well.
Absolutely, and it goes to show that all the work and travelling and everything is paying off, like you said. I don't want to mention the word, but COVID, how much of an impact did that have on your job in the European Parliament and travelling and everything?
Looking back on it now, it was a very difficult time for everybody, especially those, of course, who lost loved ones. But where we were concerned, we had more restrictions here in Ireland than in the rest of Europe most of the time. And as a result, the MEPs from Europe were able to go to Strasbourg and Brussels, and we couldn't go. And when we went, we'd have to stay for 2 or 3 weeks, because you'd have to have a test 4 or 5 days afterwards, and then a test before you come, and then a test again when a few days after coming. So it wasn't possible to either go and come back, and therefore we lost out a lot. We did do Zoom calls and all that kind of thing, but in politics, the personal touch is far more effective. Looking back at it now, we got through it. I used to have Zoom meetings here every day, here when I'm talking to you now, at home in my living room. But the connections sometimes would break down, other people's connections would break down, and it was never really fully satisfying. It's great to be back now again, meeting people and having events where people can stand up and say what they have to say, and you hear everything 100%, and there's no worries about the line breaking down or losing connection and all that kind of thing. So it was tough enough. It was tough for everybody, but hopefully it's behind us now.
The fellow who made Zoom, he's laughing during COVID. I'd say he's a multimillionaire. Would the European People's Party be one of the largest groups in the over there?
It's the biggest, yeah. It was much bigger, but we got rid of Viktor Orban from Hungary and his group, in which we lost 14 MEPs, which we just couldn't have him there anymore. He was just too outlandish altogether. But we're still the biggest group, which makes a big difference, because if you're trying to build a majority and you have your own group behind you, you're starting off with a huge advantage. Whereas a small group would find it very hard to build a majority, because the bigger groups would have most of the votes and most of the say, therefore. So if we do, EPP is our group, if we do deal with what we call the socialists, that would be the Labour group, and maybe the Conservatives or the Greens, then we'd have a majority, and that makes it easier to get legislation done. But as I say, you'll never get 100% from any group. People can vote as they wish. So we have situations where we, when a proposal is put to the European Parliament, first of all, they decide which committee does this belong to, and say it's a dual energy, to have to go to the Energy Committee, of which I'm a member. Then in the Energy Committee, they'd say, we must appoint somebody in charge of this, and then appoint someone, and you'd bid for it. And obviously, if we didn't know anything about it, you wouldn't get it. So they'd give it to somebody who was an expert in that field, and the other groups would do the same. And then they'd sit around, and they'd all make amendments and proposals, and eventually they'd trash it all out, and they'd try and reach what they call a compromise amendment. A compromise amendment is usually when four or five groups agree on something, and if you have that, then you're more or less guaranteed you're going to get a majority. If you can get a compromise amendment, then it's difficult to get a majority. So an awful lot of work goes on at committee level, going through motions, going through amendments, going through proposals, to and fro, backwards and forwards, arguing maybe about a word that you'd want in or a word you'd want out would make a difference. A word like, for instance, shall or may, that makes an awful difference. Shall means it has to happen. May means it could happen. So things like that. But eventually, you get it, the committee votes on it, and if the committee passes it, then it goes to Parliament, and the full Parliament votes. And no legislation can be passed without the full Parliament giving it its assent. That's how it happens.
It's very interesting, the process, because I don't think a lot of people know the ins and outs of it looking in. I'm very interested to... Do you know inside, when you're all inside, like, doing talking, debating and stuff, do you know in the dollars, like, you can call that, is there someone, like, playing that role over there?
Yes. There's a president, and then there are actually 14 vice presidents. So they share the chairing of the meetings between them. Because we start in the morning at 8:30, and we could be still going until 12 o'clock at night. Sure. Various topics coming up for debate. But debate is very controlled. You just can't walk in and say, I'm going to speak on this motion now, and there's a TV camera over there, and I'm going to go head for leather, so I'll be on the 6 o'clock news this evening. It doesn't work like that in the open Parliament. You have to be for speaking time. The group has only so much speaking time, so they're divided up between those who probably are most involved in that issue. And the speaking time is limited, usually to a minute or a minute and a half. So there's no time for bull or praising everybody under the sun or criticizing everybody under the sun as well. You have to decide what one or two points am I going to make here. You go up, you make it, when your minute is up, the lights start flashing. If you keep going, the president hits the hammer off the counter, and then if you don't stop, he cuts you off, no one can hear you. So it's a very well-disciplined parliament from that point of view. And I mean, if nobody can really dominate, the time is divided out between each of the groups. So every group has its say, and every representative will get a chance over a period of time, depending on the topics they're interested in, if they want to speak.
Stand Out with Ian O'Connell on Radio Kerry.
Now, you're very welcome back to Stand Out with me, Ian O'Connell. I'm here today with former president of the GAA and current MEP Sean Kelly. Sean has a very interesting story, and if you've missed the Saturday interview, you can get it straight after the show in the podcast section on the Radio Kerry website, or you can now get this show, as well as all the interviews I've done so far, on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Stand Out with Ian O'Connell. What would be, at the moment now, I know global warming and stuff, what would be the the big topics that are bringing
big topics. Obviously, climate change and global warming is a huge one, because we're going through at the moment all the legislation in relation to that. It's called the Fit for 55 package. That means that we have to be fit to reduce emissions by 55% by 2030. So we're doing things like the energy efficiency, we're doing things like saving energy savings. I'm doing the Energy Performance of Buildings Directive, which is about retrofitting houses to make them more efficient. Do you know that 36% of greenhouse gas emissions come from houses, and 40% of the energy we use in Europe is used in heating and cooling houses across Europe? Cool. So if we are going to reduce emissions, a lot of work has to be done there. So all those things have been discussed. And then, of course, you have Putin's horrible war in Ukraine. That's taking up a lot of time. The sanctions and how to deal with the lack of gas coming into Europe as a result of it, how we can get alternative supplies. And then they're moving other things forward as well, like the new cap. That's more or less finalized now. And then trying to promote the digital agenda, as they call it, make things easier for people to go digital as time goes by, establishing the rules for the use and the exchange of data, and all that kind of thing is keeping us going at the moment. And then, of course, as I said, we have the free trade agreements, which I'm involved in because I was in Australia. They'll be coming to the Parliament. They'll have to be discussed and debated and argued about. And then we will be doing the same with other free trade agreements, which are in the pipeline as well.
I remember going back, I don't know, was it last year? You, I think it was on Radio Kerry, did an open article, but you were talking about the time change going into the winter and stuff. And personally, I think that they, you know, they should just leave it. But is there any sign of them scrapping the putting the clocks back and forward?
It was almost gone 2-3 years ago, because we've been fighting this campaign now, I'd say, since I went out there about 10 years ago. And we made gradual progress. And then the Commission proposed, actually, we'd get rid of clock change. But it needed all countries to agree with it. And that's one of the, I suppose, the advantages and some respects the disadvantages in Europe. One country can often stop what the other countries want. And in this regard, you needed all countries to agree to the change. And all countries didn't agree. And then the Commission changed. Ursula von der Leyen came in, and the Jean-Claude Juncker left. So it kind of went off the radar. But it's coming back on the radar now with the energy crisis, because the research has shown that if we didn't put back the clocks at the end of this month, that it would save quite a lot of money for Europe and quite a lot of energy. So I think we should be looking at every opportunity to save energy. And this is one of them, but it probably won't happen, because you need probably more time leading into it to get agreement, and then getting agreement from everybody can be very difficult.
Very
but
good.
We'll keep acting on.
Very good. It's not, like I said, it's very interesting to hear the ins and outs. I just want to move on there to football and the GAA before we finish up. You were president of the GAA there. What did that mean to you as a proud, like, proudly coming man and a football man?
Yeah, it was fantastic, and I think it was great for Kerry, because I was lucky to be the first Kerry president of the GAA, and I was lucky to be there at the time when a lot of changes were made, and I think Kerry people supported those changes. We were ahead of other counties, thankfully, and I think they were very pleased to see me leading it. And it's a great honour, because you're only one president every 3 years, so very few get the opportunity. But for me, and I personally, it wasn't something I ever really had in my mind. My ambition was to play for Kilcowan, and like every young fella, to play for Kerry. I wasn't good enough to play for Kerry, and then I got involved in administration, and it kind of took off from there. More people sat there suggesting I should go for president of the GAA, and I said, my goodness. And eventually then you kind of climbed up along the ladder, and I was elected with, I think, the biggest majority ever in the first time I went for it. Normally before that, people would have to go for it 2 or 3 times before they'd be elected. So that was nice, but it was great to be there. And of course, my late uncle, Father Brian Kelly, whom the pitch in Glenbeigh is now thankfully called after, thanks to the great people of Glenbeigh, Father Brian Kelly Park. He was asked by, I think it was a Kerryman, was it a great honour for him that his nephew, Sean, was present in the GAA? And his reply was, to be damn all good unless he presents to Sam Maguire to Kerry. Thankfully, I had the honour of that, and I presented Sam Maguire to Dara O'Kineza, Leigh McGuelta, August R. Dara Fon, Gavila August Akui. So that was great.
Were you involved in bringing the rugby to Croke Park? Was it while Lansdowne Road has been renovated?
You have it, Ian. That's exactly it. And it just shows you how the years go by. That was a hugely controversial issue at the time, not just within the GAA, but in society. It had been really debated left, right and centre. And people in the GAA said we should open Croke Park to soccer and rugby while Lansdowne Road was being developed, because otherwise the Irish teams would have to play their home games abroad in Twickenham or Park of France or whatever. So, but it was very controversial, because a lot of the GAA people saw it as a sellout, and you can understand that to a certain degree. We developed our own pitches. We are a small country. Our native games are competing against global games like soccer and rugby. And they felt that if we opened it, that would be what they said, open the floodgates. I didn't see it that way, and many more people didn't. And after a number of years, eventually, 2005, the Congress voted to open Croke Park to soccer and rugby, and we had the great games there. And I suppose the one that stands out most is the Ireland-England game 2007. And I remember, and everybody does who watched it, the history really being made when not just our own Avian was played, but when God Save the Queen was played, 80,000 people at the match, not a single boo or whistle, total respect. And many people see that as the day Ireland really grew up and came into the modern era, not just the GAA, but Ireland as well. This was kind of a symbol that we had put all the bitterness, and there was a lot of it there, and understandably so, behind us, and sport was helping to move us forward, and it happened in our great stadium of Croke Park.
Stand Out with Ian O'Connell on Radio Kerry.
Now, you're very welcome back to Stand Out with me, Ian O'Connell, the last part of the show. I'm here today with Sean Kelly. It's great to look back and have that that memory. What do you make of Kerry hurling now? And like you said, you're involved in bringing St. Pat's to that team, and it's still going well now. Even since I had my accident, I used to play hurling up until, I suppose, mine are under 21. What do you think of the rise and progress Kerry hurling is making lately?
You know, I'm absolutely delighted with the way the Kerry hurlers have performed, where the clubs have kept the hurling going, and the professional way they're approaching it now. The Kerry hurlers now are as fit and as dedicated as the Kerry footballers, and they're as dedicated as you'll find. They have been very, very successful when you consider the small catchment area we have. And it's great altogether to see the likes of Tralee Parnells, as well as Austin Stacks, obviously, in Tralee, and then you have Killary, the Crokes, you have St. Pat's, and you have Atmore and Farries to come in, all continuing to play hurling. And when we started way back in 1982-83, that's what we wanted, to give every young fella a chance, and now, of course, girls, because Camogie has started as well, thankfully, an opportunity to play our native games. And that's really what it was all about. And it's great to see it continuing, and there's great work being done, and I'm very proud and pleased with what's happening with hurling, and indeed Camogie here in Kerry, because the Camogie is going great as well, fabulous to them. But we have to keep supporting them all and giving them 100% of our effort in every way we can, so that we can keep our games alive and strong. And it's great to see it. And really, the progress that has been made is phenomenal, really, and great credit to everybody.
Absolutely. And like you said, the camogie, and I think women's sports in general is after really coming on. You see the Euros there, the England, the Lionesses won the Euros and stuff, and it's great to see that. I suppose women's sports is getting the same recognition as men's. Were you involved that time when they, speaking of hurling, when they brought the Chris Earing Cup in?
Yes, because when I became president of GAA, the manager of Wexford that won the All-Ireland final in 1996, Liam Griffin, met me. And he said to me, "Sean," he said, "you're from Kerry. Please don't forget the small ball when you're president." And I said, "I won't." So actually, I set up a committee involving himself and John Lucknan and Cyril Farrell and Nicky English and many others, standout names in hurling at the time. And they came up, in about 6 months' work, they came up with great proposals. And one of them was to introduce the second and third year hurling championships, the Christy Rain and Nicky Rappard. And that really has been transformative because it gave a new lease of life to the hurling counties, because many of them, like Kerry, they would have limited resources in terms of clubs. And to get them to play in the championship, they played in Croke Park. The first Christy Rain final was played as a Crookton Rays at the Royal Anderson final. It was televised live. And we gave them their own All-Stars, and we also sent them on a tour abroad. So that gave me a lift, and it has been going ever since. Now, of course, we have the Joe McDonald Cup as well, the Laurie Maher. So they're all getting recognition and all getting opportunity to play at the highest level and to play in Croke Park, which, of course, is our youngster's dream. All that was a real dream for everyone before that, but it never a reality. Now it's a dream that becomes a reality for most companies, and that's the way it should be, and I'm delighted to see that progress being made.
Absolutely, 100%. What do you, I remember I met you there, I suppose it's going back 2 years ago. We were out walking in the National Park out for the direction. What do you do to chill out if you ever get a chance with all the travelling and everything? What do you like to do just to zone out and relax?
I would like to go for a walk. That'd be the best way we do it. I used to play golf, but I had to give that up because I didn't have enough time for it. But also, I'd like going to matches. I really chill out, as you say, when I go to matches. I enjoy them. I kind of study them. Because I was managing teams myself in the same, I still look at every game almost through the eyes of a manager. And I'd be saying to myself, what changes should they make here? Who's playing well? Who should be kind of changed? That kind of thing. And I enjoy that immensely. Both in hurling and football, and it is a great honour to go and see people playing, and particularly youngsters. One of the best games I saw this year was the Hogan Cup final, where the Sen were playing Nace. Unfortunately, they were beaten, I think, by about a point or so, but it was a wonderful, wonderful game of football. And once you see that, and you can enjoy that type of football and spectacle and see young people developing their skills and taking pride in the jersey, etc., I get great satisfaction with that. Because the one thing, Ian, that I have seen, and most people might look at it this way, it was only when I went to Europe I realized this. I had an idea in my head that I was going to organize a festival in Europe of indigenous games. That's games like the old games now, national games, hurling and football, of every country. But when I investigated, they have no indigenous games anywhere, hardly. So I couldn't do it. So we have unique games, and I think it's very important that we preserve them. And we cannot take it for granted because of the fact, especially now with so much TV, etc., every game worldwide is getting huge exposure, and particularly the bigger ones. So we're competing in that whole field, and it's absolutely wonderful to see that we can still draw 80,000 to our finals. I mean, most people outside of Ireland can't understand how a national game in a country with only 5 million people can draw 80,000 to major matches for amateur sports people. And that's the secret of it. So if we keep that going, then it will be unique and wonderful. And the same, of course, applies probably to our culture, our music, Now dance as well, which are again admired and loved all over the world, but very few have that kind of talent. So we owe that to our ancestors who developed this, and I'd love to know in depth sometime how actually the whole art of our culture in Orient, how they actually started, who began them, what was the thinking, how they developed. It's not easy to get it now, but certainly it happened, and we are the beneficiaries of it, a wonderful treasure trove in our country, which we must preserve.
Definitely, and it's great to see Tina G, TG Carr there on telly there, covering club games up the country and stuff, and you know, it's great for even elderly people, you know, that can travel to matches, they get to see them on the TV. Would you ever dip into sports or the GAA again?
Yeah, I'd love to. And you're actually right about TG Carr and about local radios as well, like Radio Kerry. That has been a huge advantage to promotion the game as well in Kerry, because people love to know what's going on, and having your game on the radio, local radio, people tune in, they like get to know the players, etc., etc. So it's all helping to promote it. But I would like it to do something more on a voluntary basis. Somewhere I do help out when I can, but when you're away the whole time, you can't really be on the committee because you're on your own for weekends. So from that point of view, you're restricted. But I do help out the best I can, sometimes with FOSSA, sometimes with becoming a way that I can do it. And of course, St. Pat's, I have to keep that flag flying also. So anything we can do, we'd be delighted to do so.
Absolutely. I meant to ask you this a minute ago. Did the passing of the Queen over in England, did that put a big stop to the European Parliament? Because it did stop the whole world, really. Did it have any effect over there?
It didn't stop it, no. The meetings went ahead, but they were obviously respectful of her passing, because she was a well-respected queen all over the world. And I had the privilege to meet her when she came to Croke Park.
Really?
I thought she was lovely. Yeah, I thought she was a lovely lady. She was very nice and polite. She asked me how I was getting on with the British MEPs, and I said most of them are fine. And she said, I hope we will all get along together someday. And I think that was probably really her mantra. She just wanted to do her best, and I think people respected that. But in terms of the European area, well, they obviously respected the Queen and so forth, but there was no real stopping of any activity other than maybe while the funeral was going on for a while.
Yeah, I know, she seemed a very witty woman there. You'd see clips that are re-emerging now since she passed. Sean, thanks a million for coming on now, and I really appreciate your time. And I even myself there to see the ins and outs of what the job of an MEP involves. It's very interesting, and I think a lot of people out there will get more of an insight into it. So thanks for coming on today.
You're most welcome, Ian, and well done to yourself. You're an inspiration to all of us. You were in the same as yourself, and if you look closely behind me there, you will see that the Gooch, one of my star past pupils, is in the painting by Paul Downey, who was the Croke secretary and good hurling man too from Waterford. So everywhere we've got our connections, and it's great. It helps us all to have a better life and to contribute more. So well done to you, Ian, and you, of course, half a Kilcoman man, at least.
I will say two thirds.
Two thirds, and the rest ball. Well done.
And like you said, you'd meet people abroad from Kerry, and a good saying, you can take the man out of Kerry, but you can't take the Kerry out of the man.
Exactly. And long may it continue.
Thanks for being all right.
Thank you.
Now, unfortunately, that's all we have time for tonight. I hope you all enjoyed the show, and I really appreciate you tuning in as always. If you have any questions or requests for next week's show, you can contact me through my Instagram, enoconnell321, or through my email address, ioconnell@radiokerry.ie. I'll be back at the same time next Wednesday night from 8 to 9 p.m. Until then, stay safe and mind yourself.
Keeping the kingdom entertained and informed, 7 days a week. This is Radio Kerry.